I'm Joe Wood, and I believe.
1969, the state of Georgia, USA. 2 years before he became governor of the state, Jimmy Carter is preparing to talk to an outdoors Lions Club meeting. About 7:15 p.m., an audience member calls his attention to a strange object above the horizon. Carter sees it and later describes the object as being white and as bright as a moon, before turning blue to red, then back to white. Speaking in 1973, the future U.S. president said the object didn't seem to have any solid substance to it. It was just very peculiar looking. None of us could understand what it was, he added. While running for president, Carter vowed to have a policy on openness about UFO sightings and would later instruct NASA to formally investigate reports. Once elected, however, Carter distanced himself from his claim, citing defense implications. No U.S. government agency has ever adopted transparency on the issue.
Welcome to Alien Nation, the show about extraterrestrials and UFOs, asking the question, are we alone? In Alien Nation, I talk to other Earthlings about their otherworldly encounters, and we love hearing your stories, so please get in touch. I'll tell you how to do that at the end of the show. My guest today is an artist, writer, and composer who has some exciting news about a musical he's working on. Welcome to Alien Nation, Doug Auld.
Hi, Joe. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. So, let's start. Let me see. You've had lots of sightings, haven't you?
I decided at some point to start looking in the sky when I walk around.
When was your first sighting then?
I don't know. I'm gonna guess. That's a guess. I'm gonna think about 7 to 10 years ago. Actually, my brother had a sighting when we were kids, and he said that I ran in the house, but he saw some sort of disc floating in the sky, and he said, "Doug, come on out. You got to see this. It's amazing." And he said that I was in the house. I don't remember any of it. But he said it happened. And to me, that whole little section of time, I just don't remember. So he said something happened then. But the first sighting that I got on camera, I think, is about 7 to 10 years ago, something like that.
Yeah. And so you actually took pictures of your of a UFO.
Yeah, I have them. I have them on my website that nobody knows that they're there because you need to head a little /UFO at the end of my DougAuld.com. But if you go to that site and you look and you put DougAuld.com/UFO, you'll see a selection of my daytime shots pretty much. I catch things in the day and I tend to try to carry a camera with me.
Yeah. So these photographs were taken in a New York area.
Yeah. Right. In my area here in Hoboken, New Jersey. And also I have a place, a buddy of mine own a place in Playa del Carmen in Mexico.
Yeah.
And I go to the rooftop there, and that's where I bring out my night vision scope on a tripod. I have a Luna night vision scope, and I set that up and I watch the skies, and I've gotten two or three very, very unusual things there that have perplexed me to this day. I've never had an answer for them. So, yeah, I must have 7 to 10 different kinds of UFO sightings.
Oh, how fantastic. That is really, really fantastic. Now, you're an artist, aren't you?
I'm my whole life is the arts. I started as an auto mechanic in high school because my dad owned a car dealership, one of the fixed cars. Then I started playing the piano because I saw the Doors play and I said, wow, that is the coolest thing in the world. So I went and I bought a little Farfisa organ and then studied classical piano. From piano, I started working on pianos. So I started tuning and rebuilding pianos.
Oh, fantastic.
Which was a cool way to work in my auto mechanics with my piano tuning. So I got out of the grease and onto the piano and studied piano. But at the same time, my brother Greg, my older brother, took me to see Salvador Dali's show in Connecticut or somewhere local at the time. Now it's in Florida. And I was so impressed by the art that I started to paint. He started to paint, and I would go down in the basement and watch him. And I had no art as a kid. I had absolutely no art skills. I couldn't draw anything. And I just, I just started to figure it out. I became a painter along with being a musician. And so the rest is history. I do both of them.
Oh, a bit like my ex-husband's an artist and a musician.
I think I've heard of him, yes. And I've seen his paintings. I get it.
Yeah, he's very good. He's really good. Now, what I'm most interested in, actually, is this musical. You're working on, yeah.
Yeah, let me give you a little idea on how that kind of germinated.
Yeah.
Being a painter all these years, I started to get, and being a musician, I played in CBGB in the city with a band way back in the day. And I left the music for the art because I got tired of dealing with musicians and dealing with late hours. I didn't want to do that whole have to be out on the scene kind of routine. I wanted to pull in and do things privately. So I became a painter. But then it hit me. I painted everything I wanted to say. I always have some sort of edge or commentary in all my work. So then a little bit of the 60s hippie left over in me. So
yeah.
When I decided to let the painting go, one of the reasons why I let it go is I wanted to stop piling up items, things. I wanted to stop making things. And I love the idea that music is universal. It's in the ethereal part of our world. It has nostalgia attached to it, which is amazing. You know, a song comes on that you heard 20 years ago,
yeah.
And you can remember the feeling you had. Where I don't know that painting conveys that in the same way. But anyway, I want to go back to music. But my natural music style was never going to complement anything that's going on today. I mean, the music world and whatever the music world is doing today, I had no affinity for. And whenever I would write a song, people would say, you know, that sounds like Broadway. That's what that sounds like.
Oh, really?
So I started to think, you know, maybe that's an idea. Maybe I should write a show. I got a lot of great ideas, what I'd like to express, mainly about disclosure and the topic of ufology.
Mm.
And where things felt like they're headed. So one night I woke up in the middle of the night, like, you know, coming out of the sleep into consciousness. And I just sat up and I said a word. I said the word hypnota, hypnotta.
Yeah.
And I wrote it down and I just dwelled on that word for a while. And I formed an idea of a show that had to do with those states, the hypnopompic and hypnagogic states, where we fall into sleep and somehow the world disappears, the TV goes off, we don't hear it anymore,
yeah.
And we're on our way into sleep. And in that little crossover, and the crossover coming out is an area that fascinates me.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating too.
And then Tesla and many of the great thinkers said that they tapped into these things and that's where they got their inventions. And in fact, Tesla would say that his dreams were so clear that all he had to do was invent them once he got up in the morning. So that's like, I don't have that kind of connection, but that's amazing.
Yeah.
So I've created this show. I'm about 3/4 of the way through it. I wrote all the music. I wrote all the lyrics. I'm writing all the dialogue, all the characters, everything. And I've solely kept this under my own world here.
Yeah.
Until that baby is birthed, you know, I don't want to give it up too soon. Once it comes out, I'm going to need to work with the collaborative effort that has to go into a show like this. But for now, I'm just trying to carry it through and finish it. And I would say maybe early spring, I would hope to have the show done.
Oh, fantastic. And for those listeners, you need to, can you say what the show is going to be about?
Well, I've been studying ufology for a long time, and I know a lot of the people in the field. Grant Cameron being a very, very good friend, one of the closest contacts I have, but I know so many people, Peter Robbins and this one, that one, all different people. I know experiencers like Chris Bledsoe and Nancy Tremaine. And so what I decided to do was glean some of the stories, not the exacts. It's not like I'm copying one thing or another, but I'm appropriating the spirit and the context of about four or five different sightings. And I'm putting them into a show that starts in a parallel that's a little similar to the Zimbabwe sighting, the Ariel School sighting in... Okay, but I'm changing the story. But the idea is that basically it's about two young girls at about 12 years old that are in school and have a UFO event. Nobody believes them, of course. And my main character, Nectar, that's her name, my main character, it's Nectar and Jilly, they grow up being non-believed by, you know, picked on, and mother and father saying like, oh, that's Nectar's imagination. She makes up everything. And then 24 years later, the show jumps right away to 24 years later, where they're adults living next door to each other. They're good friends. And Nectar has now become empowered, and she runs a radio blog, sort of like you, where she now goes on the radio and interviews all these wonderful people that have had these sightings. Along with her, the main character, her best friend, Jilly, who was there at the school, has taken a very, very bad turn over the years. She became an alcoholic and eventually drinks herself to death. And so it's like an event that happens where they have a divergent course. They're best friends as it's happening. Then we enter the CIA. And I have a high intelligence friend in Washington that I've kind of patterned a little bit of my story, a section of my show after. And so it's a really, it's if I was to describe the feeling you'll get from this, it's The Wizard of Oz meets E.T.
Fantastic. I think that's brilliant.
And just to let you, thank you, Joe, and to let your listeners know, I made a commitment to myself through a friend of mine who lives out in Shelter Island. I said, I'm not going to put a stitch of violence in this show. There's no violence. There's not even a curse word. There's no cursing. There's no violence. Yeah. Much like The Wizard of Oz, where there's drama, there's fear, there's a loss, there's regular stuff that goes on in life, but it's a completely clean show that way. And I've purposely wanted to do that.
Oh, I think that sounds fantastic. I think it's such a great idea. Cross between The Wizard of Oz and E.T. That's brilliant.
Well, thank you.
So where will this take place? What sort of scene is it set? Would it be in America? I mean, you know, as if it was in America.
I have a friend, Nancy Tremaine, who's got a fabulously riveting story. And that's part of my reason, and we could touch on my whistleblower paintings too. Part of the reason why I did 100 portraits of whistleblowers.
You did Max Spears as well, didn't you?
Yes, Max Spears is part of that series. Grant, there's a lot of different people you would recognize in that Travis Walton and so on. The reason why I did this series is I was fascinated with this group of people that, whether it's real or not, they felt it was real. They were compelled deeply enough to do it. And there's no real way to test or verify, but the cost-benefit analysis I look at in their lives, the stress and the nightmare they went through to hold this attitude and to keep this story going 20 years. People write this off as if it's that easy. I mean, try making something up and keeping the same story for 2 weeks, much less 20 years.
Yeah, you can't, can you?
You can't. And that's why, I mean, there's so many people that like say Lazar is a phony and this. Maybe he is, but if he is, he needs an award, an acting award or something, because I don't know how people do this. So anyway, Nancy Tremaine told me her story and I saw her video and I was so riveted by it that I patterned my main two characters sort of appropriate a little bit of what she went through with her girlfriend, Cindy. So to answer your question about where this event takes place, it's right outside of like the Detroit area in Michigan. Yeah. And maybe 1980s, something like that. Cell phones are just starting to come online kind of thing. I have to tool that a little bit more. I'm not too worried about it right now, but it's about that kind of idea.
Oh, I see. All right. No, that sounds brilliant. Yeah, I was going to ask you about your whistleblowers art. So how many did you say you did again?
I did 100. I wanted to make a very, very cohesive and strong statement about this topic of whistleblowers. I call it my whistleblowers and informers series.
It's, so, have you actually shown these, you know, done an art exhibition with these?
No, I haven't yet, to answer your question. I struggle with the art and business world. I don't get along with it because, you know, it's tied to a lot of stuff that is not really about art. And I'm a real artist. I'm a real creator. I go and I create something. When I'm done with that creation, I tend to have it on my wall, and I jump to the next creation. And I never found the right business connection or agent. I've had people rip me off. I've had people lie to me. I've never found the right connection to get the stuff out in the way I want. What I have, what I have managed to get was media. I got a New York Times article for my Burn Survivor series. In fact, the New York Times wrote a 2-page spread on my Burn Survivor series where I painted adolescent burn survivors.
Oh, my goodness.
I do get some media attention, and people write about what I do, but I don't get galleries. I'm not a commercial artist. Not that my work doesn't sell. It's just that that's not my motive. I make art, and wherever it ends up or however it gets out there will be another question.
Yeah, you should put it on Instagram.
I was on Instagram for a while. I'm big enough on social media to have a Facebook page.
Yeah.
I know that's old fashioned. And you know, a few other things, but I'm not a Twitter guy. I'm not an Instagram guy. And I actually feel that those days are still going to come. I feel that this work, this body of work of 100 whistleblowers, and I see that as one work. I'm not selling them individually. Yeah. I see the day where that will come out, that will be out there. And even Stephen Bassett, I don't know if you know Stephen Bassett in the ufology world, but he saw the series and said, don't sell that. It's going to be very valuable someday when this whole thing finally unravels.
Gosh, I'd love to see. I mean, I'd love to study them and have a real close look at them. Yeah. That's interesting.
Well, when anyone goes to my website, if you mention my website, they're all listed there. Everyone, you click on them, you'll see a bio for each one of those people.
Okay, and, where I'm going to look at them then. That would be great.
Yeah. And really the idea for everyone to understand, I'm not submitting these people as proof of anything. You know, one person's whistleblower is another person's traitor. It's like Edward Snowden. There's such a mixed read on him, or Julian Assange. So some people go, oh, he's a traitor. Some people say he's a hero. So I leave it up to the viewer, but I think this is a group of people that most people don't know. And so therefore, if they were, let's just say we had a show in a gallery or an institution of all these works, people would be looking at people and going, who is that? Maybe I should write that name down and take a look. And then that's their entrance into this world where dominoes start to fall.
So tell me about, you're 3/4 of the way through your Broadway show.
Yes.
When do you think we'll be able to go and see it? Because I want to see it.
That would be great. I mean, I really can't predict that. I'm just starting to put some feelers out to some people in the industry. And I've had some offers from people or interest in financially backing it, but nothing to really hang my hat on yet. So I don't know. The way I've always worked is just do the work, put everything you have into it, and the answers will come. Just get it done and do it right. And, the answers will come. And I have a feeling when the show is close to done, this is going to start to arrive. But the next step for me is to do sort of a rented hall, kind of get all the friends together and do a reading and play all the music.
Yeah.
See how long it is. See how it feels. Have a discussion. How does everybody feel about it? Where it's going? And then I think that's going to be the thing I plan now.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose that is the next stage, and see what it sounds like when you've but you've got good material to work with.
Oh, I'm thrilled. I am so thrilled about the songs. They're so, I come from a story song type of attitude, you know, like Harry Chapin and all, Gordon Lightfoot and, you know, all the great singer songwriters that told stories. You know, I like stuff like that. I like a narrative in the music. And these songs are also different, yet also like facets of a gemstone. They all belong. I have a song called Even Einstein Struggled, and it's a conversation with Einstein and a priest that the family know.
Yeah.
And the priest and Seth, my scientist, who's a quantum physicist, and I study quantum physics. I really find it fascinating. As a layperson, by the way, they have an argument, and Seth is trying to say nothing is real until you witness it, until you see it. On a quantum level, it's in a probability wave, and it doesn't take a form until there's an observer. And the priest, who's much more old world, is like, are you kidding me? God made grapes, and you know, a wheel, and everything is real. And so he says, well, even Einstein struggled with this, because Einstein and Niels Bohr had a very, very difficult time over this idea of, God doesn't play dice with the universe. So it's a great, very clever song. And I have material like that that's going to be fun. It's going to be entertaining, but it's going to have a Trojan horse of truth in it that's going to resonate with the right people.
You've sent us some of the tracks. So we're going to have a bit of a listen now. Should we have a little listen, or do you want to explain first?
Let me just briefly tell everyone what this song is about. Is Nectar is trying to get Jilly, who's struggling with alcoholism because she's not accepted this sighting that happened to her.
Yeah.
She's trying to get her regressed. So Seth, the scientist that they met on the radio blog, comes in. They go to Jilly's house. It's quiet. They lay her down on the couch in the old, you know, classic shrink position. And they roll her back in time to get her to start to remember what happened. That's what the song is about.
They're rolling on back, like a train on a track on a hill that's ascending, rolling on back. Space. Rocking and rolling back to a time we just can't erase. I'm seeing it now, such strangeness. Elongated eyes covering teardrop faces.
Okay, that was fantastic.
Thank you.
That was good, Doug. So what else shall I ask you about? Let me ask you about the Mexico, because I find that fascinating that you stand there and you film the night sky. That must... they have a lot of sightings down in Mexico, don't they?
They do, and a lot of times the sky is really clear and... So I'm in Playa del Carmen in Mexico, and I have a rooftop on my third-story condo unit. We built a little extra rooftop that, like, steps up to, like, a little, like, it's like a captain's chair. It's so cool. And I go up there, and I bring up the tripod and the Luna night vision system with a screen. And I scan the whole sky, and I look around, and I just, you know, I in my eye, I can notice anything that's moving aberrant to the stars. And that's what I look for. I look for any little thing. So I catch like tons of satellites. It's the things that you know aren't satellites, the things that are very big and bright but are not blinking because all planes have flashing lights.
Yeah.
That are moving very slow, that just don't seem right. They don't make any sense. I capture them, and I captured a really, really unusual thing at dusk of these two little disks. They were like side by side, straight up and down, like this, and they were just going like this, and they come down, and they come back up, and they go the height of the clouds, and they come all the way back down. And now, meanwhile, the wind is all blowing in, so I know that they're not following the wind, so they can't be a kite. The only explanation I came up with is it is some sort of kite. But who's flying a kite at night with no lights on it? You can't see what it's doing. And who has a rope that can go to the height of the clouds? It didn't. None of it made any sense to me. And I have that on film. And I also have stills of that. And I could certainly send them to you sometime.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, it's that unusual movement, isn't it, of things in the sky that you can see it's different from what we know.
And, of course, your listeners all understand UFO, unidentified flying object. We're not saying these things are from Venus. But the idea is that you see something perform in a way that you know our physics, there's no logic to it. What could be in the sky? An airplane, a helicopter, a balloon, a few theme and variations of a few things. And when none of these things correspond to any of that, you know, insects or birds or anything, then you're stuck with a bewilderment. And so many people see these things. So we know UFOs exist. We're not sure what they are. That's really what it comes down to.
Yeah. And who is piloting them?
Yeah.
So
are they ours or are they theirs? That's the question.
Yeah, are they? I'd like to think they're from somewhere else. You've shown your pictures to people high in official circles, haven't you?
Yeah, I have a probably the most unusual friendship that I have, and people in the UFO community struggle with this. Is I know Ron Pandolfi, who is high in the alphabet agencies. Ron's never actually directly told me I work for this or I work for that. I have no idea. But, you know, if you read a Grant Cameron's site right now and all the stuff coming out in Jacques Vallée's book, he's a CIA scientist of the highest order. And he part of the whole Avery thing. With all the different birds and, you know, the pelican and the this one and that one. He's sort of a total enigma in the UFO world. Of course, there are people that know him very deeply in different ways that I know him. But I happen to become very good friends with his wife, Aaliyah, and him. And they are great people. I go over there and stay at their home. I'm one of the rare people that gets to do that. I'm friends with them. I talk to Aaliyah every day, almost every day, and we carry on a good friendship. And Ron is very, very friendly, very cordial, funny. But I'm not the kind of guy, Joe, that goes over there with a pen and pencil trying to take notes from him. I'm not trying to do that.
You're a friend.
I'm a friend, but it's the hardest thing at the same time because he knows that I know that I'm trying to learn everything I can about this topic.
Yeah.
So Ron can, you know, we've taken their daughter skating. I'm very good friends and I watch over their daughter. And, you know, we've gone ice skating together and this and that. And, you know, Ron can tell anyone all about me. He can say, Doug does this and Doug does that. And how's Doug's day? If he feels like it. I can't do that with Ron. I can't go, you know, hey, Ron, what'd you do today? You know, what were you working on? You know? So it's a very perplexing kind of wavelength that I sit. And it's made a lot of the UFO community kind of nervous about me. Certain people, some people think I'm part of the CIA. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that. I mean, you're not an artist and a painter and then you get to know somebody and now you're part of the CIA. It doesn't work that way.
No, it definitely doesn't.
that's how paranoid people are. Oh, him, he's with the CIA. Grant, that's why Grant and I have a very good take on most of it. And Grant does a lot of stuff on Ron. And so Jacques Vallée has a new book out. And Ron is mentioned in that book many, many, many times. And you know, but anyway,
did you ask him about your pictures and?
Yes.
And what did he say?
I did. I went over there with my computer on I think it was near the holidays, Christmas holidays, a year or two ago, and I showed him all the photos. And you know, he took the computer and he looked at it like this, and he turned his head and he looked at it like that, and he went back and forth when I showed him my pictures, I thought Ron was going to go, well, that's a balloon. That's a fly. No, he looked at him for quite a while and he handed the computer back to me and he said, hey, he goes, those are great photos. And that was what he said. And, you know, when I talked to his wife, Aaliyah, she said, Ron doesn't spend a lot of time talking with people or sitting with people. She said he really had an interest in what you were doing and showing. He never said what they were. He remarked about one of the images that's on my site that you can look at. He remarked because it has a symmetry. It's like a round thing with a cross in it. And Joe, it came out of nowhere. I happened to be looking in the sky and the sky just sort of like a black smudge appeared. Yeah. And then I saw a dot. I saw a dot and I took 1, 2, 3 photos with my iPhone. I don't even know how I captured it. And within 5 seconds, it was gone. I don't mean it flew away. It just disappeared.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But I got those photos. And Ron made a comment about that to Aaliyah. He said, this looks like so-and-so, and they both smiled. But again, he didn't tell me what he thought it was. But I think he thought they were very credible photos.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, I wonder what he knows that we don't.
That's what everyone wants to know.
You know, Doug, that was so nice to talk to you about all you've got coming up. And I really can't wait to see this musical, Hypnota.
Hypnota, right. That's it. Hypnota. And it's a paranormal kind of UFO, ufology kind of story. But just to say on finality on it, it's extremely uplifting. Yeah. It challenges notions and beliefs. It challenges religion. It challenges science. It shows that science and religion eventually become the same thing. And that it's very enlightening and very uplifting. It's a positive message I want everyone to walk away from. I don't care what your ethnicity is, what your religion is. You walk away feeling a oneness from this show. That's what I'm trying to do.
Well, I'm 100% coming to opening night.
Okay, you'll have. I'll get you in the fourth row. Front row is too close. Right?
Okay, definitely.
We'll have you up there. That would be wonderful. I'd love to see you sometime. And are you ever in New York?
Yeah, I was actually there a couple of weeks ago, but I think I might be coming back there because I'm promoting my book that I've just, my picture book I've just done. It's called Stoned, by the way.
Oh, okay, that's right. I have a feeling I know what that is about.
Thank you so much, Doug, for talking to me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks very much for having me on.
That's our show for today. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please rate us on whatever platform you get your podcast from. It helps people like you find us. Today's show was produced by Mike Hansen for Pod People Productions. Associate producer Colette Cooper and recorded at Hackenbacker Studios by Oliver Briley. Theme music by Mike Hansen and Jamie Allen. Special thanks to Nigel Heath and our narrator, Mike Hansen Sr. If you want to share your stories, we'd love to hear from you. Just email info@podpeopleproductions.co.uk, subject matter Alien Nation. Beam me up next time. I'm Joe Wood. And I believe.